Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 14th of April. Two very interesting and important hours await you now here on the Ideas Network. The first hour, we're going to be talking about the case of Justin Hansen, but more importantly, the whole issue of international adoption. One of our guests says she places herself as the most enthusiastic end of the spectrum of supporters, finding it overwhelmingly clear that international adoption serves the best interests of existing children in need of homes. Another of our guests says the case of Justin Hansen and his would-be American family highlights contemporary fault lines in international adoptions. Sometimes not all adoptions are exactly what they appear to be. We'll be talking about this case, and I know that many of you, because I've heard from you before, have done international adoptions, and we're particularly interested in your process and how all of this has worked out for you. And I know many people have comments on this Justin Hansen case. Second hour of our program today, John Yu will be with us. He has written several books. The latest is Crisis and Command, and he is known as being a significant participant in the Bush administration's war on terrorism. He was Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel and wrote many of the legal briefs on which the Bush administration relied, including, as you know, a number of memos relating to the treatment of detainees at Guantanamo Bay. He will be with us the second hour of our program today. Both hours, you're welcome to join the conversation, and I'm sure you will. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. We have two guests with us joining us the first hour of our program. Michelle Goodwin is Everett Fraser Professor of Law at the University of Minnesota, editor of Baby Markets, and The New Politics of Creating Families. Professor Goodwin, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, great to have you here. Also, Professor Elizabeth Bartlett is with us, and she is Morris Wasserstein Public Interest Professor of Law and Faculty Director of the Child Advocacy Program at Harvard Law School. Professor Bartlett, thank you so much for being with us today.
I'm glad to be here.
Let's start with a comment that you made, Elizabeth, in a long paper that you place yourself at the most enthusiastic end of the spectrum of supporters for international adoption. Why do you place yourself there? And we'll be going to you, Michelle, after we hear from Elizabeth to find out where you are on that spectrum.
I place myself there because I think it serves the interests of unparented children very, very well and better than most available options that exist, for example, for children in institutions worldwide.
Mm-hmm. And the number of children who may benefit from international adoption is huge. I read the figures in your paper. We're talking about many, many children.
Well, there are millions in institutions now and many more millions on the streets, and I think, even us enthusiasts know that there's a limit to how many homes international adoption could provide, but at its peak in 2004, it provided more than 40,000 homes for children worldwide, and I think that figure could be easily multiplied by 10 or 100 if we had adoption-friendly policies rather than the very restrictive policies that we have today.
Hmm. I'll ask you about those policies in a moment. Professor Goodwin, where do you place yourself on this? Are you a supporter of international adoption?
Well, I don't think that it's necessarily a debate about the value of international adoption. I think it's very clear the types of economic crises that we have globally and the fact that that places children in very vulnerable positions, in particular children of color. So I recognize that. But that is not to say that we don't have fault lines also in international adoptions, and it is possible that they can also obscure the need for children in the United States to, in fact, be brought into homes. We have what years ago was considered by Landis and Posner a glut of black babies in foster care, and many took umbrage with the characterization of why there are so many black children in foster care and in need of homes in the United States. But that said, we have a domestic need, and in addition, we also have some, there are also sometimes some issues with international adoption that are worth addressing. Interestingly, last week with what happened to Justin Hansen highlighted his situation, but just days before in Hastings, Minnesota, we had another Russian adoptee who had also been released by his American adoptive family, who brought a gun to school and threatened to kill his classmates and his teachers. And this was only two or three days before the Justin Hansen situation made international news. And I imagine this one, too, once connected, will also make the news.
I wonder why it didn't make the news when it happened.
Well, it leaked out slowly, and it was a smaller Minnesota city. But what's very interesting are the traumas that this young man experienced. And also what distinguishes it a bit is that those parents made significant efforts to get appropriate treatment for their child, but were very unsuccessful. They had threats against their lives, just as what the Hansons suggest. But these threats included suggesting that he would cut the family up into tiny little pieces and putting rat poison in sodas and things like that. And the family just a year ago surrendered him to the state of Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. Are these cases quite the exception, do you think, Professor Berthelet?
I think adoption abuse cases, as they're often characterized, are definitely the exception. As if you look at adoption overall, there is less abuse and neglect in adoptive homes than there is in biological homes where there's never been any, you know, allegations of abuse and neglect. It's a, you know, if you look at the social science on adoption, where you know, social scientists look systematically at these families, adopted kids are incredibly well treated, better treated than kids by most biological parents, and adoption serves as a way to really help kids who both are adopted at infancy. Those kids do very well, comparably with kids raised in biological homes, and adoption serves very well to help kids overcome the trauma suffered in institutions. So, you know, what I think is a tragedy is when these occasional abuse incidents arise, and they're going to arise everywhere. As I say, they arise more often in so-called normal biological families. There are incidents of abuse. I think what's a tragedy is when policymakers respond to these occasional incidents, as they often do, by shutting down international adoption, either temporarily or permanently, and by slapping new restrictive rules on it. And I do think the debate, sadly, in some way overall, maybe not between me and Michelle, but overall is about whether international adoptions should serve as an option for kids, because there are many powerful forces out there, including UNICEF and Save the Children, for example, that I believe think that international adoption should either be eliminated or serve as a last resort. And if you look at what's happened since 2004, the number of international adoptions have dropped from over 40,000 to about half of that, and they've dropped each year since 2004. So I think we're in a real crisis in terms of this institution, which, as I see it, really serves in children's interests very well.
And part of the concern, I'm sure, Professor Goodwin, is this cultural issue, as it has been in the United States for African-American children going to white families, and it doesn't happen as often, white families going to African-American white children. I don't think that happens very often at all.
No,
The same with Guatemalan families or Russian families or whatever, that you're best served, there is a belief, by the culture that you are biologically a part of.
Well, it's interesting. There is a study released by the Donaldson Institute just at the end of last year in November that was a unique study, because what it did was to look at the issues surrounding adult adoptions and interviewing adults, in particular South Korean adults who had been adopted into the United States. And one significant issue that came from that study was the majority of those adoptees feeling as if there were cultural challenges and conflicts that weren't appropriately addressed by the families that they were adopted into. And for some, this was an issue of severe proportion, and for others, it was milder. But it certainly did confirm some of the concerns that many have about transnational adoptions. Now, it's true that bringing children into a loving home will help to conquer many types of challenges, and I think that's important for us to understand. And it is also true that the types of incidents that we have seen in the last week happen to be more isolated. But it's worth Americans thinking about the language barriers and also some of the other cultural barriers in order to determine what the real emotional impact of the adoptions, what these adoptions will be for their children. For example, David Smolin writes about and has talked about his personal experience in adopting two girls from India. He did not know that they had been stolen from their mother. He also had not known that the age that was listed on the materials that he received from the orphanage that took care of the adoption services had lied about their ages. And so when his daughters had what would have been considered adjustment issues, they were actually quite broader than what we would typically categorize as adjustment issues. These were girls who had been stolen. Equally, we've seen in the state of Minnesota cases where young women who've been adopted from India, where agencies have also lied about their ages. I mean, this can be very traumatic for parents because they're not always aware of why their child might be experiencing such difficulty integrating into their families. They may not know about the child's personal history.
Right. And how do we make sure we know about personal history, Professor Barthollet?
Well, can I go back to the,
sure.
the social science issue? Because I think, I mean, I've spent much of the last 25 years on the social science. I really focus a lot on that, and I've looked particularly at the transracial adoption studies and transcultural, transnational adoption studies. I think, first, that if you look at the studies of kids placed in a same-race home as compared to an other-race home, in terms of all the good social science, there is not an iota of evidence that kids do worse by virtue of being placed across color or national lines. I think the Donaldson Institute that was mentioned basically loves to focus on what I would call the junk science and not the good social science. I think, secondly, the real comparison for children, the millions of unparented children worldwide, is not whether they grow up in a loving, nurturing, same country home or an other country home. It's whether they grow up in an institution or on the street as compared to an international adoptive home. And it's just beyond absurd for anybody to argue, although plenty of people argue that, you know, these kids will do better in an institution in their home country because they'll enjoy their cultural heritage. Kids die in institutions, and studies demonstrate that IQ, emotional development, physical development, suffer with every additional month in an institution.
What is the problem that UNICEF and Save the Children, they're thought of as quite reputable organizations, what problems do they have with international adoption?
UNICEF likes to say it's not entirely against it, but I think most of us in the adoption field recognize UNICEF as the major opponent to international adoption. And why are they against it? I don't know. They mouth a lot of the things that I find just not credible, that, you know, children should enjoy their cultural heritage. I think that, in fact, UNICEF largely defers to state sovereignty issues. And yet, you know, what I find ironic is it's not as if these countries are fighting to hold on to their children as much as UNICEF is pushing countries that they should hold on to their children. So I think it's hard to tell what's really motivating UNICEF. I don't know to what degree it is that they've got a stake in in-country programs, and I don't know to what degree it is that some UNICEF people, at least, may think that international adoption diverts from the what we should be focused on, which is how to solve world poverty and how to make it so that all birth parents can keep their kids. Now, you know, I too would like to solve world poverty. I just don't see it happening tomorrow. And I also think that if we allow and encourage international adoption, we actually move further down the road toward helping all the kids who won't be able to be placed in international adoption, because we bring money into the country that helps support and improve orphanage conditions and create alternatives to orphanages, and we create, you know, much more of an international mindset, I think, among people in the United States in terms of their being willing to care about, think about, and address poverty in other countries.
Mm-hmm. Professor Goodwin, it's my understanding that the Russians have temporarily suspended adoptions by U.S. families. Would it be a good idea, do you think, to temporarily suspend all of these adoptions until we can figure out some of the horrendous abuses that you have outlined?
Not necessarily so, but I would like to raise two issues here. And the first is that it is important that we give greater scrutiny to international adoptions, much in the same way that Guatemala has done. Guatemala imposed a two-year moratorium on the transnational adoptions. Many Guatemalan children were placed in the United States, one per 100 citizens in Guatemala. So, huge number. But what also the state had learned after investigation was that not all of these children were actually up for adoption. Some children were the victims of political policies, meaning that some of the kids were trafficked as a means of combating government rule of law, if you will. Some of the children allegedly were trafficked for sex, although that much I am not aware of, although government officials have suggested that, and they've even suggested that children were trafficked for organs. These issues might be debatable to some, but I think it makes a significant statement when government officials have made such a stop. And we do, in fact, know of cases where there have been DNA tests that have linked parents in Guatemala who said, my children have been kidnapped from me and I want my babies back, and those children have been found in the United States. So while I agree that, of course, an American home might provide luxuries and benefits that a child might not otherwise have in his or home country, we also, I think, would look a bit more critically if these were Americans whose children happen to be taken away from them. And we would not make a distinction whether or not they lived in a very large home or they lived in a trailer. We would say that even parents who live in trailers deserve to keep their children. Now, that said, of course, the elephant in the room is, why is it that we have not successfully addressed adoptions in the United States? And one issue that's raised is that Americans might prefer to have clean adoptions where, in fact, they don't have any involvement from the parents and can raise their children pretty much independently without worrying about the interference of other family members. International adoptions provide that opportunity a bit better than adoptions do in the United States, where it would be easier, in fact, to track down one's parents. And equally, we have a concern about bringing children out of the dire situations that they face in the United States. And I think that a very strong argument could be made about increasing the well-being of kids in the United States who, after a life in foster care, we know can lead to prison, high dropout rates, and other types of social conditions that we would otherwise want to guard against in the United States. So while there's certainly very strong interest in adopting from abroad and what that can do to help inspire communities abroad, we have communities in the United States that certainly deserve that same type of commitment and inspiration. And I think it would behoove us to think more critically about how we can overcome some of the barriers and challenges that we've faced with this in the United States. And I would say that one of the challenges that we all know about was, in fact, imposed by the National Association of Black Social Workers. And I think that there's been significant criticism about the barriers in transracial adoptions in the United States. So I think that we want to have, and we should have, a more rigorous and robust discussion about that. And that should be co-commitment with thinking about international adoptions.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We have several of you on the line already, so join us if you'd like. A line is open at 800-486-8655. We're taking on the issue of international adoption this hour, which, of course, you can't talk about international adoption without talking about adoption and foster care in the United States because of the much publicized case of Justin Hansen, who was sent back to his native Russia last week by his adoptive mother and grandmother, who said the boy was psychologically damaged and they could no longer care for him. There's been a suspension of adoptions from Russia and an investigation of what actually, nobody knows what actually happened in this case. We're looking at how rigorously this is monitored in the countries where the children are born and in the United States. I'm wondering why there are waves of adoptions that take place in certain countries, Guatemala, China, India, remember Romania, there were a number of adoptions from there. The overall benefits of any child from the United States who doesn't have a home or from anywhere in the world having a home so they can be loved and nurtured. And in no way are we suggesting that adoptive parents, that these cases we're talking about are truly exceptions of this kind of parent abuse. To your phone calls momentarily, I'm Kathleen Dunn. I gave you the number, right? The email is talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, John Yu will be with us. He's written several books. His latest is Crisis and Command, a history of executive power from George Washington to George W. Bush. As you'll recall, he received a great deal of notoriety from 2001 to 2003. He served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel of the U.S. Department of Justice, where he worked on issues involving foreign affairs, national security, the separation of powers, and has been the author of what has been known as the torture memos. He will be with us, hour number two. All right, let's go to phone calls for both our guests. Professor Michelle Goodwin, professor of law at the University of Minnesota, editor of Baby Markets, Money, and the New Politics of Creating Families. Professor Elizabeth Bartlett is also here. Professor Bartlett is a professor of law and faculty director of the Child Advocacy Program at Harvard Law School. We start our calls with Mark from Oshkosh. Hello, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you, Mark?
I'm good, thanks. You guys have really kind of covered a lot of what I wanted to say, but I'll just maybe add a little bit. I have a domestically adopted child and a Guatemalan adopted child. And my brother-in-law has two Filipino adopted children, so I have a little bit of experience in this area. And I guess my point just that, you know, we hear these exceptions to the rule, and I forget which professor it was that mentioned earlier, actually we have more cases of abuse in natural-born children families than we do in adopted families. And, you know, if we look at the numbers, while we need a robust international process, we really could do a lot if we would just take care of the kids, the millions of kids that are abused every day that are natural born here in the United States.
I think our guests would agree with you, Professor Bartlett.
Yeah, I'd like to deal with that because Michelle has also talked about that. And I, first of all, just don't see why we should prefer our so-called our kids in the U.S. to kids worldwide. It seems to me, you know, they've all got human needs and human rights and deserve to get nurturing homes. And secondly, I think that it actually bad off as the kids growing up in foster care are in this country, they're way better off than most kids in institutions in other countries. Kids die at high rates in institutions, and they are destroyed in ways that really go beyond even the destruction that, that foster care wreaks. Thirdly, I think when people adopt, they're more likely to adopt again and to adopt other kids. And Mark mentioned he has one domestically adopted, one Guatemala adopted kid. I think what we really need to do is open the door to adoption, encourage people to think of this as a way to form families, and get as many kids as we can into homes and keep going down that road.
Mm-hmm. Human rights, really, as you have said, Elizabeth, are at the core of this debate over international adoption. Human rights is the issue.
It is. And it's, you know, to me, one of the most vital child human rights is the right to life and to grow up in a way that you can hope to have a decent future life. And kids, human kids, need families mm-hmm. and need early nurturing for that to happen.
Here's an email that's come in, Professor Goodwin, from Alan. I think domestic laws should be looked at as well. As an adoptive father, we made a conscious decision to go international. We're currently working on upgrading our paperwork to adopt internationally again. The Russian fiasco is a mess. All of that would have been caught by the social worker adoption agency. I'm convinced our agency would not have allowed the adoption that has been in the news. My daughter is super, and I can't imagine my life without her, and hope I never have to.
Sure. And you know, these are very compelling stories, and there's tremendous beauty in parenting, and I don't think that that's an issue that we're debating at all today. And as I said, it is, in fact, a generous statement about the human spirit when Americans will adopt abroad, and in fact, when Europeans adopt black children from the United States who are otherwise left in foster care because there's no preference for them. But I would also connect the issues that Elizabeth has raised with international adoption, again, domestically. There are children in the United States who die who've been a part of the United States abandonment system in foster care. We may not see those deaths connected directly to the foster care homes and the group homes, although we have in New Jersey and other states, Florida, I mean, a number of states we've seen these just in recent years, but we also see those deaths carry out in other ways. The foster care system in the United States has been linked to a prison system in the United States, which is its own type of psychological and emotional death. We also know that one in four black males are part of the criminal justice system. A number of these black men, males were, in fact, products of broken homes that led to foster care homes. So when we talk about spirit being destroyed, death,
sure.
and also human rights, we have to also connect those very issues to what is at home. I think we tend to think about human rights as an issue that's external to our borders, rather than conceptualizing it as something that is also right here at home. And I know that we've done a much better job of that, conceptualizing a kind of human rights agenda when it relates to gender issues, right? But I think that we also need to think about that domestically as related to children's issues as well.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for your call. Let's go next to Warren from Madison. Hi, Warren.
Hi there. I'm calling as a father of two adoptive children, and I support having international and domestic adoptions. Both of my daughters are African American, and one of the things we found was that with both daughters, once the case study was complete, we had placement within 2 months. The costs were much lower. And I think the notion that somehow a child is based on their skin color as a member of a particular culture is erroneous. There are no single black culture or white culture. We have multiple cultures, and if we really want to think about diversity, our children can grow up and be the members of the culture of their family. My oldest daughter celebrated her bat mitzvah quite successfully, and I think it's a mistake for people who are thinking about adopting to buy into the notion that somehow the color of their child's skin determines the culture they must be brought up in.
Did you adopt your daughters when they were infants, Warren?
Yes. One daughter was 8 weeks old and the other was 13 weeks old, which is the other advantage. I think the earlier a child is adopted, the earlier they're in their permanent family, the better off they are.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to voice agreement with that, obviously. This is Betsy Barthelet again, but also with Michelle, that we should do everything we can to get kids out of foster care and into adoptive homes. And again, as early in life as possible, taking into account respect for the possibility of family preservation. Also, people should know that Congress passed, I think, a very wonderful law called the Multi-Ethnic Placement Act that does knock down racial barriers and make it much easier for people to adopt transracially within this country. It says that adoption agencies cannot use race as a basis for placement or delay or denying placement. And I believe it would be great if that law we have now here in the United States could be a model for international law, because, again, in terms of what Warren said, I don't think we should see kids as quintessentially belonging to wherever they came from. And I think from kids' point of view, what they need is a family they can belong to, mm-hmm. wherever it is.
Well, part of the problem here, Professor Goodwin, is I can remember not that long ago doing talk shows with African-American advocacy groups before we had this law, saying, you know, it's not a good thing for black children to be going into white families. It's a different culture. They're having a hard enough time with identity as it is. And so we've got that recent past. I agree with what everybody's saying here, but we have a past that said quite the opposite. Right now we're saying something different.
Sure. You know, we have here is our American dilemma, that we have urgent pressing needs currently, and we have a backdrop of a racial history that has not been fully unpacked mm-hmm. or addressed at multiple levels within our society. So it is true, I have an interracial family myself, and my husband is white, and I have a white stepson, and we have a biracial black daughter who's the stepdaughter of my husband. So we live this multi-racialized life. And one has to understand that there are challenges living that type of life in the United States, but there's incredible beauty that comes from it. I think the trauma that's identified by activists who have opposed or are concerned about transracial adoptions in the United States comes out of a fear that families will not acknowledge what those differences happen to be, which then can cause difficulty for children as they grow up. I mean, I don't think we have to racialize it to understand that if children do not feel comfortable coming home and sharing their experiences with parents, then it can lead to a very difficult life growing up with those parents. It might also lead to trust barriers as well. These are issues that can be mitigated and addressed. I think the importance is that that actually takes place, that we have the maturity, the honesty, and wherewithal to speak honestly and openly about cultural differences, even within our families, and to acknowledge that the ways in which we live out our lives may be very different within a family.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Lorna from Milwaukee. Hi, Lorna.
Hi.
Hi.
I hope you can hear me because I'm on a cell phone.
Wait, I can hear you.
I'm calling because I'm hearing both sides of these discussions and don't disagree with anything that's being said in terms of the fact that I think that adoptions are valuable and that adoptions save children and certainly can improve the lives of children both in this country, adopting from other countries, or whether our children are adopted to other countries where they seem to be accepted more. But the bigger issue, sort of the elephant in the room that I don't think is ever discussed, and I have two adopted children from South America and a birth child, is that it's not always so much just the fact of adoption. It's not just so much the fact of where they're adopted from, or are they of a different culture, or are they of a different race, but the idea of adoption itself. And I say this because I have struggled for almost 20 years with one of my children who suffers from the effects of being adopted. And I'm not sure if either of your guests are aware of what some of these things are. One of my children, and I know many other children and parents who have adopted, whether they're from the same country as my children or other children, and we get together, and when you suddenly talk, you suddenly realize that the issues that we have experienced are not unique to ourselves, but that they are very common among adoptive families.
And what are those issues?
Pardon?
What are those issues?
They have recognized from their birth that they do not belong to you. And I know that this can sound a little bit odd, but when we went through so many troubles with my daughter, I began to read some books. I don't know if either of your guests are familiar with Nancy Newton Barrier and her work on the primal wound.
Yes, I've read it, and I'm very skeptical about it. I'm very skeptical about that and the whole body. But you go ahead, because I'd love to address this.
Do you have an adopted child?
No. What?
Are you skeptical? Do you have an adopted child?
Yes, I have two adopted children, and I've spent, as I said before, a lot of time on the social science in this area, and I've written about the sort of stigma surrounding adoption, and I've read various books, The Primal Wound, and I think in my view, there's a whole lot of very negative literature about adoption out there, but the negative literature is based on, it's what I call the junk science. It's based on sort of surveys of search movement members who, you know, have a bias against adoption often. And if you look at what I call the good social science, sort of controlled studies that compare either random samples or different samples where you control for sort of differences, I think that good social science shows that it, for the kids who are adopted at birth, there are close to no differences in terms of various measures of self-esteem and how well they do in life and how bonded they are with parents as compared to kids being brought up by their biological parents. I think almost all the problems that adopted kids have to do with the kids who aren't adopted as early infants, the kids who are adopted later and are affected by the various bad things that tend to characterize life between birth and adoptive placement. So
my daughter was
adopted. That's my strong view about the research, and I have a chapter on that research in my Family Bonds book. It's the one called Adoption Stigma.
Hmm.
I just have really disagree with the kind of theories that Verrier throws out in the birth trauma.
He'll give you a brief response, Lauren, and then we need to move on.
Right?
If you want to have a brief response.
If you have children like this, and I've talked to many parents who do, and we love our children dearly, and we're doing everything we can to help them. And I think the idea is that the disservice is to the child and to the adoptive families by not being aware that these children will experience some problems, some issues that birth children will not. And it is not necessarily 100% of children that are adopted. But if you look at statistics of children who are adopted, who have emotional issues, psychological issues, who are placed in treatment, who are placed in residential care centers, you will find that the number of adopted children are much, much higher than those of birth children.
Absolutely, and it's because they've been, most of them, abused, neglected, kept in foster care, kept in institutions before they get adopted. If you look at the limited body of social science on the early adopted kids, the ones placed in very early infancy, you don't see those problems showing up.
Mm. Well, let's talk about that issue then, because from reading about what's going on internationally, and there's been so much press as a result of the Justin Hansen case, I've been reading that there are countries that hold children for a long period of time. There are families who think they're going to get a child at infancy and the child is in an orphanage for 2 years or for 3 years. Two questions here for both of you. Let's start with you, Professor Goodwin. How do we, because people will want to adopt internationally, and you know, more power to everybody who wants to take in a child and give him or her love and a life. You know, sometimes it's a life in as opposed to not having a life.
Yeah.
How do we regulate internationally what's going on here to make sure there aren't people who are getting money for giving up their children in terms of making sure that very early on they have loving homes?
Well, this is very difficult to do on the international level because many Americans will adopt from countries where they have not lived and where they don't have language capacity. So it is true that that money is a significant factor. The rising cost of international adoptions is something that we want to pay attention to. And, of course, given that the United States is a leading importer of children internationally, this certainly can provide great opportunities for agencies that are well organized to help Americans achieve the goals of becoming parents. But it also can incentivize the more nefarious, if you will, or those who might be interested in committing a fraud. And we know that those cases do exist as well. So I think disincentivizing to some extent the rising financial costs of international adoptions is something that is actually important. I think one of the ways in which parents can try to get a better understanding of how international organizations that facilitate adoptions operate is, in fact, to try to be in touch with other parents who've adopted using those agencies. And I think better preparation and information is critically important. I also think that this is an international issue that's worthy of address. And so this case, Justin's case, I think highlights the need for a broader international dialogue about these same issues. And as Elizabeth has pointed out, we've made inroads in the United States with thinking about much more critically at the federal level how to promote adoption and to minimize certain barriers, including those barriers by culture. That also can be a part of a more stimulating international dialogue about the status of adoption.
Elizabeth.
So my sense is that the main thing that is wrong with adoption regulation now is that it's too restrictive. So there are plenty of laws out there that forbid the abuses that happen. But abuses are always going to happen. We should clamp down on them. We should send the perpetrators to prison. We should not imprison the children by yet more restrictive regulation. And I think that, you know, when you talk about there are a lot of delays now in placing children, there are. We've got law and regulation in place, or countries do throughout the world, that basically systematically abuses children by requiring that they stay in institutions for years before they can be freed up for adoption. And I want to go back to the Guatemala example. So in my view, the real Guatemala story is that for years, 5,000 kids a year got early adoptive homes. They were placed at ages like 4 to 6 months. Then it became 6 to 8 months. But they were in foster care, many of them, rather than institutions, from 0 to 6 to 8 months. They were therefore relatively healthy and at low risk in terms of future development. That was a good adoption story, in my view. Yes, there were some abuses. We should have put the people who paid birth mothers in jail. There were none, you know, there were only incidental abuses of the kind that, you know, wrong DNA or kidnapping that Michelle mentioned, very few documented cases of that. What the so-called law reformers did was to shut down Guatemala so that for the two-year moratorium, 10,000 kids who could have gotten good homes didn't. 10,000 birth mothers who would have liked their kids to grow up happy and safe didn't have that. And what Guatemala has now done is shut down private intermediaries, which means the death of international adoption. They have announced that a maximum of some 200 older and seriously disabled kids are the ones that will be allowed to be placed internationally, and that's all. So to me, that's a tragedy, and it's being done by people who, you know, claim the halo and say that they're the good guys and they care about kids' cultural heritage. Well, you know, it's a travesty, and I think it can only happen because the kids in institution are silent, voiceless children, the ultimate powerless people.
Mm. More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about international adoption this hour. Our two guests, Elizabeth Barthollet, who is a professor of law and faculty director of the Child Advocacy Program at Harvard Law School, Professor Michelle Goodwin, who is professor of law at the University of Minnesota, editor of Baby Markets, Money, and the New Politics of Creating Families. Returning to your phone call, Char from Hudson is next. Hi, Char.
Hi. I'm calling. We have a domestically son, and he was adopted as an infant, so we've gone through that process. And now we would like to do another adoption, but adopt a child, a toddler or an older child. And so we have done some research on trying to go through that process, and we've run into a number of roadblocks with adoption agencies, of course, looking at adopting infants, and our county had indicated that they just deal with foster care. I'm just wondering if you can give us any advice on where to turn next.
Oh, you have the right people to give you advice on this issue, that's for sure. Who would like to begin?
Do you want advice as to how to locate the toddler or older child?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, there certainly are going to be lots of toddlers and older children available, both domestically out of foster care primarily, and abroad, because abroad, sadly, today, they almost have to be toddlers by the time they're freed up for adoption. So I'm surprised that you're having trouble with the agencies, unless what you're saying is that you don't want to adopt kids who've been in foster care.
And I would say, and I guess that's a question, but I would also add that being you're in Wisconsin, Illinois is right next door, and it has there are programs, very creative programs that have been instituted in recent years to help facilitate the adoption of children of color, especially from foster care and also group home situations for those that are a bit older. And there has been programs to actually help subsidize some of those adoptions. So I would strongly urge you to consider what's even right next door.
Thank you, Char. I guess she hung up, but I hope you got that advice. We go next to Ron from somewhere. Hi, Ron.
Hi, I'm in my car.
Okay, Ron, go ahead.
I'm an adoptive parent. My wife and I adopted two children from Peru, and we're white.
That's where my two children were adopted.
Oh, really?
And we adopted them. Our son is now 22, and our daughter is 21.
And mine are 22.
However, one of the things that kind of pushed us into adopting in Peru was at the time we adopted, the laws in the United States considered us too old to adopt in the United States, which I thought at the time was ridiculous. And the other thing we ran into at our time was it was very expensive. And we really wanted to adopt. We adopted a 2.5-year-old and a 3.5-year-old. And I would say that in my life, that is one of the best things I've ever done in my lifetime. And I'm very, very proud of how both of these children are turning out. But there have been challenges. But I think anybody that wants to adopt in the United States and maybe adopt different ethnicities or older children, if they run into the issues that we ran into, it really makes it a lot more difficult. And I don't know if you have any comments on that, but
yeah,
I've always thought that was not a good thing because there's so many kids that need a home.
Yes.
I think you raise really wonderful and important points, and that sadly we surround adoption with a lot of restrictions, and they're, you know, typically justified as being in the best interest of the child, but I don't think they are. And so we do screen parents for age, disability, various things, and we make adoption generally expensive, although Michelle's right, a lot of the adoptions out of foster care are either free or subsidized. But I think that if, you know, to me, one of the crazy contrasts is when you look at the world of reproductive technology, we're inviting older people and single people and gay people and all kinds of people who are disapproved in the adoption world or put low on the hierarchy. We're inviting them to go out and produce new kids. And in my state of Massachusetts, we mandate that insurance cover the production of kids, whether it's IVF or whatever expensive technology and how often it's tried. Whereas if people want to give homes to kids that exist and need homes, we make it expensive and we put them through, you know, problematic home studies, which I think often screen them out even when they're fully fit parents. So I think we desperately need reform along the lines that I think, Ron, you're suggesting.
I'm wondering if we only have about 30 seconds left. Can you suggest a website for people for more information that's just very honest? Professor Goodwin?
Well, I would say that even looking at the CDC website is very, very helpful, both on assisted reproductive issues and also adoption issues.
Okay.
I know that Elizabeth has suggested that the Donaldson Institute tends to trend more towards the alarmist approach, but I would also recommend that their website be consulted, because the more information that parents,
of course,
prospective parents receive, the better.
Yeah.
And
your suggestion,
the adoption network in your community. There are lots of agencies. There are lots of people who have dealt with these agencies, and there are going to be people out there to help you. And most adoptive parents love to help other prospective adopters.
Oh, sure. And get together, too. Thank you both. You've been great guests. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Really issue I feel we could have talked about for hours and hours. Michelle Goodwin, Professor of Law, University of Minnesota. Professor Bartholet, Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this program, Chrissy Pease for on-air production, and you for your participation.